That is Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Joining us, the moderator of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. So, debt crisis over. Who won the argument, do you think?
Well, I mean, the fact that we are avoiding default means that all Americans won the argument because that was really the real risk here. Borrowing costs are already going up. Wall Street already nervous. And so now 3 days out from the X date, we do have an agreement that President Biden says he will sign later today. And then we'll speak to the public around 7 p.m. Eastern time to explain some of the caps he made in terms of future spending deals, something he said, remember, that he wouldn't negotiate on as long as Republicans held the debt ceiling, the borrowing limit hostage, as he put it. Well, they did, because we came down to the wire. So we're going to talk about what's in the actual deal. Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, if you do want to have someone take a victory lap, he certainly will be doing one, because the Mountain View Pipeline, a project of his that would run natural gas through West Virginia and Virginia, he got some expedited approval included in this deal.
I saw that after the Senate vote, Patty Murray got up and made a speech appealing for regular order, return to regular order, where you actually decide what you're going to spend and you agree on that before you incur the debt. Is that going to happen?
That has been the call for some time, because remember, Congress hasn't been able to come to budget agreements for years now. And Kevin McCarthy, Republican Speaker of the House, says he wants regular order. He wants this process to work. So the politics need to follow that. And this certainly wasn't the way that the debt ceiling conversations typically happen, but it was a way that forced some conversations on future spending in regard to the budget. But we're coming up on that fall appropriations conversation that typically happens, so we may see some haggling still. And to be clear here, both sides of the aisle had some ticked off partisans who felt that their sides gave too much.
Right. But I mean, doesn't this show that there is at least, what would we call it, a compromise caucus in the House of Representatives that actually can get something passed? And if there is that kind of core that is willing to compromise on things, could they do something big like immigration reform?
Sure. Well, the immigration reform that hasn't been delivered on in decades seems to be the major ask that no one has been able to deliver on. Certainly, it would raise that question of, can you get something bigger done now? This was, to be clear, this was a game led by the moderates in both parties. Progressive Democrats really objected to the White House agreement and were very vocal about their criticisms of the deal. On the extreme of the other party, you have Republicans in like the Freedom Caucus who were really furious and publicly critical of their speaker for not getting more dramatic cuts to spending because of the extreme problems in terms of spending more money than the government takes in here. So you have ticked off the extremes, and this is a game led by moderates. Can they work across the aisle again? Remember, Kevin McCarthy got 149 votes out of his 222 seat majority. He is a slim majority. He got a good number of them. He's going to flex muscles and say, look, I can lead even a divided caucus. Democrats would look at that and say, you only got this passed because we helped you do it, because it took Democratic votes to help him. But yes, both sides working together is supposed to be how government gets things done.
Yeah. Well, I'll admit, rabid idealists drive me nuts. I tend to watch congressional hearings in my spare time, you know, while I'm at the gym. And I've seen a couple, which included Republicans and Democrats on immigration, for example, who both acknowledge that the farming economy is in big trouble because there's no legal way to get the farm workers that they need. I saw a hearing on the electrical grid yesterday where we're going to have blackouts if the greenies start eliminating natural gas and coal before the alternatives are ready. This is a serious stuff, and I can't believe people are still, you know, arguing on the fringes when we have, mm-hmm. we have bigger deadlines than just a debt problem looming, don't you think?
I couldn't agree with you more. And I also agree that these issues have a level of complexity that, doesn't lend itself to black and white bumper stickers of for and against. There's nuance. And even the White House on the issues of environmental issues on the environmental front, has said, President Biden has said, we will need fossil fuels for a good decade or more. Therefore, that's why they endorsed the permitting reform bill that Joe Manchin was trying to get across the finish line and ultimately did not because of the objections of a fellow Democrat. So in this bill, he got that tucked in, that one pipeline, the Mountain View pipeline, but didn't get some of the other permitting reform provisions in there that both sides of the aisle did want to see. That would just make it faster for projects that receive federal funding to be approved and to get underway. So, yes, there's a lot of really serious issues that need to involve some serious conversation. We'll try to have some of them Sunday.
Margaret Brennan, the moderator of Face the Nation. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. As I'm sure millennials have been told again and again, the career is dead. And Bruce Feiler writes about this in a book called The Search, Finding Meaningful Work in a Post-Career World. I know you as the author of Walking the Bible, where you actually visited basically the Bible physically. So what did you do to prepare for this book?
Well, it's so interesting that you say that. And it's nice to be back with you. And I've had a few transitions in my own work life. And what happened was basically, essentially about a decade ago, I was the walking guy because I was walking around the world and hosting television and writing books. And then I got cancer in my left leg and I couldn't walk anymore. Uh-huh. Right. And then I had some financial troubles. And then my dad got very depressed and tried to take his own life 6 times in 12 weeks from Parkinson's. And I realized I was a storyteller and I didn't know how to tell my story. And when I did, it turned out everybody else had moments in their life where this happened to them. And so I have spent the last 6 years crisscrossing the country, collecting hundreds of life stories of Americans of all ages, all walks of life, all 50 states, looking for clues for how we can find meaning in our lives. And there is no area of life that involves more change right now than work. So 70% of us, just let's look at the numbers for a second. 70% of us are unhappy with what we do. 3/4 of us plan to look for new work this year. That means 100 million Americans will sit down with someone they love today, tonight, tomorrow, and say, I'm not happy with what I'm doing, and I want to do something that makes me happy. So this has been building for a while, but what we've missed is sort of a toolkit. So what the search does is gather these inspiring stories and give you a set of questions. I call it 21 questions to find work you love that will help you find the meaning and purpose that you want right now.
What are the key areas that contribute to career dissatisfaction?
The way I would say it, Colleen, is that a lot of people are unhappy with their career and they think something is wrong with them. But it's not you. It's the idea of the career. So, you know, Dave said this at the outset. The idea of the career was invented a century ago. And what was that idea? Well, what happened was, you know, rural people were fleeing into cities and people were coming from overseas. And suddenly you had all these people with work needs. And so the idea was you pick something at 21 and you do this for 50 years. That is not the world that we live in anymore. And my data show that the average person goes through what I call a work quake 20 times in their lives. That's every 2.5 years. These don't all lead to new jobs, but there are moments when you say, am I doing what I want to be doing? Okay. And here's what's interesting. Women go through them more than men. And as Dave said at the outset, younger workers go through them more than older workers, which means their number is going to increase. And so the biggest mistake people make, to answer your question directly, is they do what they think that they should do. I should want higher salary. I should want the bigger office or the higher floor. If that's what you want, great, go for it. But in fact, what happens is that most of these work quakes are not led by something that goes on in the workplace, but something happens with our family, right? Maybe we have children. We want to spend more time with them. And so therefore, we don't want a job that involves lots of travel. Maybe we have an aging relative. Maybe we get cancer. Maybe there's a pandemic. So these things begin outside the workplace. And so the biggest mistake that you can make is to just do what you think you should. The biggest thing you can do right is to do what I call personal archaeology, right? Don't climb, dig. Go into yourself and figure out, who am I? What's the story I've been trying to tell for a long time? And then go do that.
And it sounds like this could lead you to destinations that you never thought you'd go. I mean, you talked to an Amtrak police officer.
Yeah, I love the story.
What's fulfilling about that?
I love this story, actually. I mean, I'm so glad you asked. So her name is Susan Venturelli. She's an Amtrak. In fact, she's a woman who never really worked. She sold Amway products for a long time. And then her father died, and he was the bedrock of the family. And she said, you know what? I'm not. And her mother was lost and didn't know what to do. And she said, you know what? I'm not going to be that person for my children. I want to be the bedrock. So she logged on. She was working at the time as a security guard, and she went to police training school. She became an Amtrak officer, and she started, and she enjoyed this work. But then she went through a workquake, and so she rearranged her schedule. And so now every Monday, she doesn't work on Monday so she can take care of her grandchild. That's her care job. And every Saturday, she sells brownies at the farmer's market because that's her hope job. And this is a perfect example. Huge pivots in her life, depending on where she was in her life. What do these stories have in common? Everybody makes at some point what feels like the unright choice, the wrong choice, by everyone else's standards, that for that person is the right choice. Listen to yourself. You have the answer. You come on this journey, you'll be inspired by these people, but you can find the happiness you seek, the meaning you crave, and the success you deserve on your own terms.
Bruce Feiler is the author of The Search, Finding Meaningful Work in a Post-Career World. And I'm so glad that your own journey led you to yet another book.
Thank you, guys. It's a privilege to be with you, and I'll see you down the road.
This is the Adams Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. As you know, I've been harping on these cuts to the IRS, which were part of the whole debt deal, so I thought we'd get a professional opinion from our tax whisperer, Ken Williams of CLA. The IRS took a little bit of a haircut here, and I want to know, Ken, if this is going to make a difference in response times and audits or not. There seems to be a dispute over whether this is truly a debilitating cut for the IRS. What do you think?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about this, Dave. The short answer is it doesn't look like it's going to have a big impact in the short term. Treasury already indicated that the funding that they have should be sufficient to allow them to manage their current operations. I think what we are looking at is the prospect of the long-term improvements of the IRS perhaps being affected by this. Because Treasury is making plans over the next 10 years of all the things that they want to do to improve their automation, to use artificial intelligence, upgrade their systems, as well as hire additional auditors, examiners to ensure enforcement. And they're nervous now that with this restriction, this is just the start of new things. And so they're a little hesitant to take on some of these big plans over the next 10 years if, in fact, halfway through, it's going to be cut and they're not going to be able to finish the projects they've started. So I think that what we're facing is over the next 10 years, it could have an impact if this is a sign of future cuts to the funds that were made available just last year.
I was reading the CBO report on the IRS funding, and it got very complicated. I'm not sure I completely understood it, but apparently it's more than just money. It has to do with the rules that the IRS has to follow to hire these new people. What can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, it is complicated. And as we said before, the worries that people had about all this money being funded to the IRS, that in a few short months that there would be all these new auditors out on the streets. Well, it can take 1 to 5 years just to find those people and train them and put them out in the field where they can be effective. And that's some of the complexity of how you bring these people in. And the funds that are given to Treasury are a bit fungible. You can say it's for this, but it affects that. And so that's where a lot of the argument is this really for enforcement? Is it really for improving their processes? Does improving their processes make them more efficient at examining people? And the answer is probably, yeah. In fact, recently they looked at as part of this spending cut, they said, well, cutting $1.4 billion from their budget will probably reduce revenue collection by $900 million. So there is a relationship, even though it really doesn't impact how many auditors are out in the field right now. It makes them more efficient in what they're doing.
The big concern I have is, well, there's a couple. I think the deficit, the debt has gotten way too high. And that means you either have to cut spending, which is tough, or collect taxes. And I think or raise taxes. And the best way to raise taxes without raising rates is to collect taxes that are already owed. That just seems fair. And that brings me to the second part. A lot of our system's reliability depends on whether people think it's fair. If they think it's a corrupt system, they're going to do everything they can to game it. If they think it's fair, then they're more likely to comply. And it just seems to me that it's ridiculous to try to defund the agency responsible for bringing in the revenue. And so, but I have to know what's at stake here, because the estimates, of course, are all over the place. You had Donald Trump's IRS director saying it could be like $1 trillion a year, which I thought was astounding. As a tax professional yourself, what is a reasonable expectation for what the extra revenue would be that the IRS could collect if it were fully staffed?
Well, I don't profess to have all those numbers where I could really do an objective analysis. And I think that, you know, CBO and other institutions can do a better job than I can. But I can say that, you know, there are two prongs to this. There's the enforcement piece of finding people that aren't complying with the tax law. And then there's just the confidence piece. And the confidence piece has to do with, do people feel that we have an equitable system, that if I pay my taxes, I'm not a fool because the guy next to me isn't?
Right.
And some of that has to do with just when I call the IRS, do I get through? There's a frustration level that undermines people's confidence in the system if they feel like, well, gee, I wrote a letter to the IRS and it took 6 months for them to respond. The system's broken. They're not even catching people that aren't doing things correctly. Why should I trust the system? So the IRS is really focused on trying to demonstrate that they are using this money to improve their processes, to make their systems more reliable, the communications easier and more equitable, because they realize that if they're going to continue to get this funding, they've got to be able to show that they've used the money effectively.
From Clifton Larson, Allen, our tax whisperer, Ken Williams. Ken, thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Time for the Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Robert W. Baird. A therapeutic writing center in Hartford, Connecticut, is helping thousands of kids and adults from around the country. CBS affiliate WFSB's Irene O'Connor has this story.
In the middle of the city, there's a quiet little piece of the country.
This is like a place where I'm able to lift the weight off of my shoulders.
Princess Mason has been coming to Ebony Horsewomen since she was 5 years old. She's now an instructor.
The environment that I live in is not the best. It's like, there's a lot of violence that goes on, and mentally it takes a toll. And then once I get here, it's just peace and quiet.
Tiana McFadden came here at age 9 to be on the competitive riding team, but she stayed because of the healing.
I realized that there was more aspects to the horses. It was very therapeutic for me coming after school and, you know, de-stressing to do the homework again.
Ebony Horsewomen was founded by Patricia Kelly in 1984. She grew up in Hartford and learned about horses from her neighbor in the 50s.
Brushing them, riding them, even riding a horse gives you that rhythmic motion that helps to rewire the brain. They begin to relax the child, and the child begins to talk and be able to release some of the trauma that's in them.
Children and adults can learn to ride, take care of the horses, from feeding to cleaning, and even operate a little store.
This summer alone, there's going to be over 100 children and adults in therapeutic programs here.
With so many costs for feed, grain, hay, and vet services, the Liberty Bank Surprise Squad stepped in to spread some kindness.
Patricia, we're actually here with the Liberty Bank Surprise Squad.
Oh, my God!
And we have a little surprise
surprise.
Oh, my God. So this is tremendous. Liberty, thank you so much.
That is from WFSB's Irene O'Connor.
7:48, Seattle's Morning News. And from the GNRS List Show, here is G. Scott. So you were upset that people were making fun of President Biden tripping?
I mean, I ain't going to lie to you. I ain't upset. I just find it interesting. Let's go back to when Trump kind of tripped. And I remember Ursula and I, we talked about it. And during that time, I'm like, why? Why are people making fun of people that fall and trip?
We all trip.
So we all trip. Yes. So I'm not going to speak for you guys. Let me just speak for myself. If you put every time I walk out of the house, there was a camera on me, I promise you guys, you might find me scratching my butt.
Yeah.
You might find me picking my nose.
Little toot.
You might call me a little toot.
Yep.
A couple times. You
Absolutely.
Feel me?
All the time.
Especially when you're by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Then you trip and fall. When's the last time you tripped? Matter of fact, the older I get, the clumsier I get.
Yeah. Some of your really intricate shoes, I imagine sometimes you get caught up in them. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So anyways, I know that, you know, a lot of people laugh like, oh, there's Sleepy Joe. Ha, 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 ha. Like, would you laugh if your mama tripped?
It's just the lowest common denominator.
It's the lowest.
I'll tell you why I agree with you. And I see, Dave, you're poised to play the sound bites. And I hope we don't, because I really would love us to set a policy of turning the other cheek in these instances on both sides of the aisle. Mm. I was listening to our newscast yesterday in the afternoon. Aaron Granillo, Nate Connors, awesome team. CBS News was right before them.
Right.
And the anchor reported that President Biden tripped, which some might argue is an important note about the health of the president. And then right after, they played and President Trump reacting to that trip. Are we TMZ now? CBS Network?
Right.
Is that news?
Right.
When we are just airing the insults like kindergartners on network news. And so I actually yelled at my radio. I was like, are we TMZ? You know, like, it to me, I was really disappointed in our network's decision to stoop that low. I think we can. And so I hope we do that on Seattle's Morning News.
Dave, this is your chance.
What do you think, Dave?
You often
err on the side.
I think it's all dumb.
Putting it all out there.
But people talk about it, so we cover it. But I go back to Gerald Ford. And Gerald Ford made Chevy Chase's career. Gerald Ford was, former football player. He would stumble on the stairs. And Chevy Chase became a national icon by doing Gerald Ford pratfalls, tripping on stairs, tripping over the Oval Office dog.
But Chevy Chase is a comedian.
Exactly.
Right? That President Trump is supposed to be a candidate.
No,
Ron DeSantis
President
is supposed
President
to be a candidate.
Trump is a stand-up comic. Let's just, get that clear right now.
Interesting.
So he's...
Kind of is.
I mean, I expect him to do that.
What I don't expect is for us to air it, though.
Yeah. So...
Well, now... So now we got the serious part out of the way.
Yes.
Now let me have some tell you guys the conversation that I had with my homeboy about President Biden falling. Mm-hmm. And we both was like, yo, what is it about? Because when President Biden, when he fell, he fell. Ooh, right, he fell.
Yeah.
What is it about when we trip and fall? Why do we always look back at the spot?
Yeah, because it's the spot.
You know what I'm saying? We we look at, Joe looked back at the spot.
He pointed at it.
Why do we look back at the spot and be like, you know what? You ain't right. You know, I was minding my own business. Well, you know I'm on camera. You know the whole world is watching. And you tripped me. Dang, you did it.
But you saw what it was.
What was it?
It was a sandbag.
Because
for the staging, it was like holding down the bunting or something. And it was, and when they stage sandbags, they're always black, so you can't see them, right? So even if he had been looking down, he might have stumbled on it.
Yeah.
I've certainly stumbled on things that I left on the floor, like my shoes. So,
I've also seen Biden try to, recover image. Like when he was in Ireland and he was at like some sort of celebration in Ireland and there was a big U-shaped stage and, he was, he had his aviators on, even though it was nighttime, and he gave a little jog, he was walking out and then he gave a little jog like, see, I can
he
jog.
He did that this time too.
Did he?
He jogged off the stage.
Yeah. So he's like, I'm fine. See.
Now I'm learning something too. The older we get, your recovery Nah, don't try. just let the fall happen.
Well,
just,
no, that's just, how you break a
just,
hip.
Man, just like, ah, no, pow.
That's how
just
you
like,
break a hip, G, then it's all over.
I think you do worse to your body trying to, and try to hurt the fall. You, oh, shoot, my neck and my back. Friday reference.
Well, he's got Secret Service. Yeah. They're his sandbags to fall on.
Well, next time he stumbles, you should get right down to 35 push-ups and show him.
Yeah, exactly. Can you do 35
Can you
push-ups?
Do 35, Dave?
Oh, yeah. Why not?
What? I promise you right now, I cannot do 20 because of my shoulder.
Well, yeah. That's the thing. I have a good shoulder.
Do you still start each morning with pull-ups?
No, but I'm working. I can do like 5 now. I used to be able to do 7.
Yeah.
But enough about me. G and Ursula at 9 o'clock.
It's time to go back to the 80s this weekend in Tacoma. Cairo News Radio's Paul Holden has more.
This is what the Greater Tacoma Convention Center will sound like this weekend as some of the best pinball players come to Washington for the 2023 Northwest Pinball and Arcade Show. Over 400 pinball machines and arcade machines will be on full display and playable for the public. From the latest and greatest licensed machines, old wooden machines of the past, to passionate homemade fan creations, the Northwest Pinball and Arcade Show is a dream for any fan of video game history. It takes a lot of work to put on the show, and it's put on entirely by volunteers, like sponsorship and promotions director Dan Halligan.
Me and everyone that participates just does it because they love the hobby and they like putting on this event and they like bringing games to the public to play. We're sharing our hobby with the world this weekend.
Setting up the largest arcade on the West Coast takes days of effort, moving teams, traveling to different regional collectors' homes to bring the games to play.
It's a lot of stuff to manage. There's a lot more than just games there. There's tournaments. There's custom homebrew games. We have speakers to line up and fly in. It's a lot of work, but it's also a lot of fun.
Since moving to Seattle, I've learned how important pinball is to the region and the influence this area has had on the game and on the pinball industry as a whole. I asked Halligan for a PNW pinball lesson.
Pinball has been popular here for quite some time. Shorty's downtown was one of the first barcades in the United States. It's been here for about 26 years. I think they had their 25th anniversary last year. And in the last maybe 15 years, kind of corresponding with our show going on, the pinball scene has really exploded with tournaments becoming a really big thing and bar leagues. So a lot of local bars and arcades try to have enough pinball machines to have their own tournament team and to host tournaments. And that's exploded around the Northwest, especially in Portland and Seattle.
I was born after the big boom of the arcade, but I've always loved arcades. The sights, the sounds, the art on the cabinet, and people like Halligan tell me nostalgia has helped keep the scene alive.
I used to go to arcades in the 80s as a kid, and the first time I went to someone's house and saw that they had some arcade games and a pinball machine in their house, I was amazed. I remember sitting outside the arcade when I was a kid, you know, sipping my like big gulp with my friends going, I'd love to own one of these games sometime. And then I realized as an adult I could. And that's when I started collecting. And then for me, it just blossomed into finding a community of collectors, sharing our collective wisdom, helping each other fix games, and then putting on this show. I enjoy the community aspects of it. I enjoy sharing my hobby with the public.
The Northwest Pinball and Arcade Show acts as an interactive museum, giving people the chance to experience not only the games of the past, but the innovation that has helped make video games one of the biggest entertainment markets in the world. Pinball machines have grown from wooden machines with just a couple of flippers and bumpers to multi-tiered metal machines of beautiful mayhem. I asked Halligan just how much pinball has changed.
Fundamentally, they're very similar. I mean, they have the same basics of flippers, pop bumpers, drop targets, the same silver ball banging around. But now they're multi-level. They're run by full computers. They have color screens. They have animations and video modes. They have real sound designers that spend a lot of time putting together a big sound package for the modern game that integrates like a band's music. So there's a lot of more modern licensing that's involved with doing a band or a movie one. And there's certainly a lot more software development than there would have been in the past, as well as sound development and trying to come up with new innovative things for a similar format.
Included in this weekend's events is showing off a couple of new machines, including one with a theme about a local band that I know a certain Seattle's Morning News host is excited about.
One of the interesting things at this show is we're going to have four of the brand new Pulp Fiction pinball machines, including Mark Ritchie, who designed it. And they worked with Quentin Tarantino on that, and he was a fan of the older games from like the 80s that he grew up on playing. And so there's a lot of stylistic throwback elements to it that makes it feel like an older machine. There's the new Foo Fighters pinball machine. I think we're going to have five of them there. So it's our local band got big, and the pinball machine is great. I just played it the other night for the first time.
The arcade has always been about having fun and creating memories. That theme continues at the Northwest Pinball and Arcade Show, something that Halligan cherishes every show.
I love the look at the show when a dad walks in with his kids and has just this big grin on his face, and he's pointing to these different games and yelling to his kid, "I used to play this. I was the king of Defender 20 years ago at the arcade." And seeing the delight on his face as he shows his kids these games, and his kids get to play them and they have fun. I love that. That makes it all worth it for me right there.
If you want to set a new high score on your favorite pinball machine, the 2023 Northwest Pinball and Arcade Show is this weekend at the Greater Tacoma Convention Center. Tickets are still available at nwpinballshow.com. Paul Holden, Cairo News Radio.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.